Welcome, Tom, to the Albert Camus Society's annual meeting. And Tom Hammer is going to read his paper or work us through his paper, The Formal Structure of Existential Absurdity. You have the floor, sir.
Yes, thank you, Eric. So welcome, everyone. I'm going to propose a little bit of an analytic approach to a very continental topic, trying to formalize what we mean by existential absurdity. I'm not sure if you can all hear me correctly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. So I just start off then. So the formal structure of the absurd. The history of the notion of existential absurdity is rich with a collection of sufferings, nausea, anxiety, dread, dizziness, vertigo, manic laughter, radical skepticism, meaninglessness, irrationality, contingency, vanity of vanities. Yet it can be painstakingly difficult to discern a pattern among these iterations of absurdity if they share anything at all. And even within the work of an individual author, the notion of absurdity can be far from homogeneous. In A Myth of Sisyphus, for example, Albert Camus alternates between a plurality of absurdities, the inability to attain absolute knowledge, hope for an afterlife in the face of utter annihilation, the repetitive nature of work, and the indifference of the universe, to name a few. At the same time, he and his critics seem to presuppose some degree of unity implied by their talk of the absurd, often rendered in the capitalized singular. What does it mean then to speak of existential absurdity? And trust a wealth of different meanings surrounding the notion, both within and without Camus, we are at the risk of either conceptual emptiness or ambiguity. And this does not seem to be a particularly solid basis upon which to build a philosophy of the absurd. In order to clarify what we have been talking about since the advent of existentialism and absurdism, and to avoid talking past each other in the future, this paper attempts to elucidate the formal structure of existential absurdity. How is absurdity structured across different accounts of the absurd? In order to anchor the concept in, as well as differentiate it from commonplace usage of the term absurdity, this demarcation of the formal structure includes its meaning both in ordinary language and in an existential context. Conceptual clarification is, however, not the only purpose of this philosophical inquiry, as the formalization of existential absurdity also provides us with formal criteria according to which we can evaluate the validity of responses to existential absurdity. For the sake of demonstrating this criteriological utility, the final section of this essay assesses one particular response to existential absurdity, irony, as it is articulated in Thomas Nagel's critique of the Camusian response. Unfortunately, I don't think there's time for this during the talk, but we'll see where we go from here. Put briefly, I argue that existential absurdity is defined by the inescapable contradiction between the anticipation that something be the case and the reality that it is not. The conjunctive nature of the absurd, first section. Similar to its namesake in logical discourse, the existential notion of absurdity describes a contradictory relation. Zooming in on the relational dimension of absurdity, this means that existential absurdity cannot consist in an atomic fact, indivisible, so to speak, but must rely upon a conjunction of facts. In other words, identifying the absence of God or the inescapable prospect of death as the absurd is in itself insufficient. Such facts need to be accompanied by another fact in order to deserve the predicate of absurdity. Unfortunately, the literature on existential absurdity abounds in opportunities for mistaking one of the components for the absurdity itself. Despite his vigilant emphasis upon the conjunctive nature of the absurd as a comparison, a confrontation, or a divorce, Albert Camus in The Myth of Sisyphus describes death as the most obvious absurdity, making it seem as though the sheer fact of mortality is absurd. Yet our impending death can only be absurd in relation to, for example, dread in the face of nothingness, or an assumption implicit in the way we organize our lives, that we have an infinite amount of time on our hands. Likewise, absurdity is only applicable to the nostalgia for unity, as Camus puts it, when the object of that unity is irretrievable, a figment of the imagination, or even absent altogether. Whereas many authors merely neglect to accentuate the bipartite nature of absurdity, carelessly, so to speak, Jean-Paul Sartre in Nausea does the exact opposite, describing with the utmost self-consciousness absurdity as a singular, non-relational property of existence. When the protagonist of the novel, Antoine Roquentin, becomes enraptured by the root of a chestnut tree, an inner monologue follows, revolving around the root's absurd mode of being, using this encounter as an opportunity for phenomenological exposition. Sartre explicates the idea of non-relational absurdity. Quote, a movement, an event in the tiny colored world of men is only relatively absurd by relation to the accompanying circumstances. A madman's ravings, for example, are absurd in relation to the situation in which he finds himself, but not in relation to his delirium. But a little while ago, I made an experiment with the absolute of the absurd. This root, there was nothing in relation to which it was absurd. End of quote. Rather than a comparison, it is the brute existence of the root, its sheer bareness, that constitutes absurdity. Although this poetic notion of a rootless root has an oxymoronic quality to it, suggestive of something conjunctive, the conjunction here is mere semblance. According to Sartre, nothing else is needed for the configuration of this absurdity beyond the mere proposition that things are without foundation. This notion of absurdity is recapitulated in Being and Nothingness, a more argumentative than literary work. Quote, what I call the absurd is the universal contingency of being, which is, but which is not, the basis of its being. The absurd is the given, the unjustifiable, primordial quality of existence. End of quote. Surrendering ourselves to the novel's takeaway, we might conclude that existential absurdity is grounded without addendum in the groundlessness of existence. This analysis, however, is incomplete. The groundless bareness of the root is only absurd in relation to the demand for a rationalization of its whence and wherefore. That is to say that we demand a ground where there is none, or that there is no ground where we demand it. Human beings have the tendency to look for foundations, to rationalize why things are the case, and perhaps even to pose the question of rationalization in its global form. Why is there something at all rather than nothing? The absurdity of Roquentin's experience thus seems to emerge from an incongruity between, on the one hand, the presumption or desire that everything has a rational foundation, and on the other hand, the groundless reality of the root. Again, existential absurdity is never singular, never born from a single fact, but always springs from conjunction. In Being and Nothingness, Sartre once again confirms the bifurcate nature of this absurdity when he contrasts the foundational vacuity of existence with the desire to become God. Discerning within the human psyche the delusional presumption that we can ever be the first cause, an immovable mover standing at the basis of existence, Sartre identifies this Promethean ambition toward the godly as the desire to found being. Thus, the absurdity in Sartre's philosophy may be understood as the conjunction of the presumption or hope that existence be founded and the actual groundlessness of existence. Again, absurdity is relational. Another interpretation of absurdity as indivisible can be found in one of the greatest writers of absurd theater, Eugène Ionesco, who writes in his essay about Franz Kafka that the absurd is that which is devoid of purpose. Cut off from his religious, metaphysical, and transcendental roots, man is lost. All his actions become senseless, absurd, useless. End of quote. With his emphasis on rootlessness, parallels with Sartre's account of absurdity are striking. But again, the lack of purpose does not seem to be absurd of its own accord. In comparison, the Andromeda galaxy, 2.5 million light years away from the Milky Way, does not seem to have a purpose, neither in and of itself nor for human beings. Yet it feels to be a reasonable candidate for absurdity. Only when we think that it should have a purpose does the purposelessness of the Andromeda galaxy become absurd, that is to say, only by virtue of a relation. The same holds for equivocations of absurdity and meaninglessness. This mistaken view of existential absurdity is so widespread that it is echoed in ordinary dictionaries, such as the Merriam-Webster dictionary. Absurdity, according to the writers, is, quote, the state or condition in which human beings exist in an irrational and meaningless universe and in which human life has no ultimate meaning. This meaninglessness can, however, be no more than a constituent of the absurd rather than absurdity as a whole. What is needed, once again, is something like a desire for meaning. Part two, the contradictory nature of the absurd. As might have already become clear from the above discussion of the relational nature of absurdity, the absurd goes beyond the merely conjunctive in its contradictory nature. Thus, it seems to be more than a peaceful coexistence of realities in the way that Paleolithic dietetics and Rococo porcelain peacefully coexist. Indeed, it is an incongruous conjunction of facts, which Camus describes in similar terms. Quote, there are absurd marriages, challenges, rancors, silences, wars, and even peace treaties. For each of them, the absurdity springs from a comparison. I am thus justified in saying that the feeling of absurdity does not spring from the mere scrutiny of a fact or an impression, but that it bursts from the comparison between a bare fact and a certain reality, between an action and a world that transcends it. The absurd is essentially a divorce. It lies in neither of the elements compared. It is born of their confrontation. In other words, the relational structure that is so characteristic of existential absurdity is one of contradiction. There are commonplace usages of the term outside the realm of existential philosophy that render the contradictory nature of absurdity especially plausible. When someone believes today to be both Wednesday and the weekend, that seems absurd, as Wednesday and the weekend are mutually exclusive. if one believes there to be an afterlife and at the same time endorses the view that death annihilates the soul, that is absurd for similar reasons. The subsistence of the soul seems to be a necessary condition for the possibility of an afterlife. Beliefs can be rendered absurd, not in relation to another belief of that person, but in conjunction with beliefs held by other people or society at large. Take, for example, the belief system of a Christian fundamentalist. Given the overwhelming amount of evidence in favor of our planet being billions of years old, it is widely taken to be absurd to believe that the Earth was created on October 23rd, 4004 BC, as had been calculated by Archbishop Usher in the 17th century. It is for this reason that Feinberg, in his article Absurd Self-Fulfillment, describes absurdity as, quote, what is palpably untrue or unreasonable, end of quote, given, of course, the palpable truth or reasonability of another proposition. Back in the domain of existentialism, resonance of this type of doxastic absurdity can be found in Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling. Here, Kierkegaard tries to interpret the myth of Sisyphus, being ordered by God to sacrifice his son Isaac. Abraham, with his endless faith in the Lord's benevolence, could not believe that God was going to be so cruel and take away his beloved son without precedence. At the same time, he obeyed God's commandment, devoted as he was, and had he not been stopped by an angel at the verge of murder, he would have killed his son. Hence, Kierkegaard assigns the notion of absurdity to Abraham's bipartite belief that on the one hand, Isaac will not be killed, and that on the other hand, he is going to kill Isaac, beliefs that seem to be mutually exclusive. It seems, however, somewhat far-fetched to call the relation in most cases of existential absurdity contradictory in the same sense as we use the term contradiction within propositional logic. For where exactly is the mutual exclusion in, as Camus calls it, this confrontation between the human need and the unreasonable silence of the world? It does not seem to be the case that existential absurdity can be cast into the definition of contradiction in formal logic, P and not P. In this paradoxical statement, P is both negated and affirmed. In the typical characterizations of existential absurdity, there appear to be no propositions such as existence has an absolute ground, or death is the annihilation of consciousness, or human beings are tiny specks in a vast universe, that are simultaneously true and false, or simultaneously believed and not believed. Likewise, a need for something, as described in Camus' characterization of absurdity, is not the same as the actuality of that thing, as needs can fall short of being actualized. In fact, the human need to which Camus refers actually does fall short of being actualized by virtue of the so-called silence of the world. Hence, no logical contradiction, or so it seems. Kierkegaard again gives us reasons to question this assumption when he identifies the absurd with the conjunction of the need to choose and the inability to choose. Quote, "What is the absurd? It is, as may quite easily be seen, that I, a rational being, must act in a case where my reason, my powers of reflection tell me, you can just as well do the one thing as the other. That is to say, where my reason and reflection say, you cannot act, and yet here is where I have to act." End of quote. Due to the lack of sufficient reasons for making a decision, while still being in a situation in which even not choosing is a choice, there's a contradiction inherent in our agency, as we are confronted with both necessity and impossibility. This existential absurdity may be formalized as follows. It is necessary that P, and it is possible that P, where P is defined as I act. This amounts, however, to a perversion of operators in deontic modality. That is to say that upon closer inspections, inspection of the impossibility and necessity involved here, there seems to be a discrepancy between the meaning of necessity as normative necessity and the meaning of possibility as motivational possibility. In classical modal logic, the negation of possibility would be equivalent to the necessity of negation, but we cannot equivocate the motivational impossibility of acting with the normative necessity of not acting, as one can still be motivated to do the dishes when there is a demand to leave the dishes undone. Therefore, the relation between the operators defined as such is not one of mutual exclusion. And accordingly, the Kierkegaardian conjunction does not seem to be contradictory in the logical sense of the word. What is it then? The closest approximation of approximation of contradiction in this logical sense is to think of either of the facts constitutive of absurdity as a propositional attitude. On the one hand, there is the desire that life be meaningful, for example, while on the other hand, there is the fact that life is meaningless, where the propositional contents of these attitudes are mutually exclusive, that is, contradictory in the logical sense of the word. Likewise, the above-mentioned description of Kierkegaardian absurdity may be formalized as the contradiction between, for example, the expectation that there be an absolutely sufficient reason for action and the reality that there is none. Still, the experience of existential absurdity need not be propositionally articulate in order to be real. Indeed, Meursault, the protagonist and narrator of Camus' The Stranger, never goes into detail when it comes to the nature of his absurd condition, let alone the elements constitutive of the absurdity. But that does not mean that the character is not experiencing existential absurdity. Similarly, the absurdity present in Schopenhauer's characterization of the existential condition, revolving around the contradiction between the expectation that positive satisfaction will be the outcome of the desire's fulfillment and the reality that satisfaction is merely a negative eradication of the desire itself, can be felt as suffering and frustration without knowing that this is the absurd insatiability that constitutes the suffering. To echo David Sherman's distinction, quote, the absurd is both an experience and a concept, end of quote, and not seldomly the experience of the absurd presides over its cognition. This is the end of the second section. I'm not sure how much time I have left. Didn't keep track of that. Couple of minutes, perhaps. Sure. Section three, constituents of the absurd. How then should we define the individual constituents of this incongruity? In The Absurd, an article by Thomas Nagel, he defines absurdity from surveying its usage in everyday language as the result of aspiration or pretension and reality in conflict. Quote, in ordinary life, a situation is absurd when it includes a conspicuous discrepancy between pretension or aspiration and reality. Sometimes someone gives a complicated speech in support of a motion that has already been passed. A notorious criminal is made president of a major philanthropic foundation. You declare your love over the phone to a recorded announcement. And as you are being knighted, your pants fall down. End of quote. Addressing Nagel's final example, we cannot help but notice the discrepancy between the honorable nature of knighthood and the embarrassment in revealing one's private parts. One aspires to honor, while the result is, in all probability, shame. It renders the situation unmistakably absurd, except perhaps if the prospective knight were at the hands of the naked monarch in Hans Christian Andersen's The Emperor's New Clothes. In such an exceptional case, the knight would merely disclose the most illustrious of fabrics, thereby completely matching the fashion standards. That is to say, once again, that no reality is inherently absurd, but only in relation to what is expected of it. There is merit in this characterization of existential absurdity as the contradiction between pretension and reality, especially when we consider some paradigmatic examples of the absurd. We live as if we have an infinite amount of time on our hands, while we are sure to die within a few decades at best. Likewise, we pretend to benefit ourselves when satisfying our desires, while such satisfaction is all too often not beneficial to us, as Dostoevsky would have it. And we act as though our values have an ultimate foundation, despite the fact that they are all contingent, as Sartre and Nagel would put it. In my mind, one of the primary virtues of the term pretension is that it captures both the affirmative intentionality and the dissimulative dimension of that affirmation. What it does not seem to capture, or so it may be argued, is the emotional gravity that may occur in the experience of existential absurdity. Pretension seems to imply some sort of detachment, whereas we remain very much invested in the desire, expectation, presumption, or other attitude toward that reality. With Nagel himself focusing on the seriousness with which we remain devoted to our values, as the pretension that stands in contrast with the contingent reality of those values, it seems odd to speak of pretension here. When, for example, one's child burns her hand on a hot stove, one does not simply pretend to care. One really does. To give another example, when one, in a Schopenhauerian vein, desires positive gratification in the face of the exclusively negative, one does not exactly pretend, inasmuch as one remains attached to the desire, to the satisfaction of that desire. This critique of pretension is misleading for two reasons. In the case of the child burning her hand, the object of pretension should not be sought in the degree of care, but in the motivational foundation for such care. After all, the parent is conceived within the Nagelian framework as pretending to have absolute reasons for tending to her daughter. Secondly, pretension does not necessarily include an excessive mode of detachment and can also consist in a form of attachment. Consider, for example, the pretension inherent in someone undergoing a process of grief, stuck in an attitude of denial. After the death of her partner, she initially denies this reality. Surely there must be an incongruity between the subconscious pain and the expression of that pain on the surface level, implying some degree of detachment by virtue of her pretensions, but that does not at all mean that she experiences no pain, no emotional gravity. By acting as if her past partner is still alive, she displays quite the opposite of detachment, namely the attachment to the idea of her partner being alive. That is to say that pretension need not exclude commitment to the object of pretension. I'm looking at the time right now, and I guess I'm somewhere around the limit. I think I'm going to wrap it up from here with a couple of brief remarks. So as I said at the beginning of this talk, I think existential absurdity can be defined by a contradiction, as we discussed, and in particular, a contradiction between an anticipation and a reality that are in some way mutually exclusive. And one thing that I find particularly interesting and would like to discuss with you as well is that dimension of inescapability. So the extent to which existential absurdity can be differentiated from other kinds of absurdity or other facts or theories like nihilism by virtue of the fact that it cannot be transcended. That is, it is intrinsic to human life. And yeah, I think I'll just leave it at that. And I'm sure there's more food for thought later on. So thank you.
Thank you, Tom.